Coming up on Tech News Today, Apple's done with this whole contact list controversy. It's over. They're putting an end to it. Also, LightSquared may have had the end put to them as well by the FCC. And why Georgia hates the internet. All and more coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 15% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT2. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Ayaz Akhtar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we take the tech news and we sit it down and we give it a stern talking to.
So yeah, we're not bad.
We're not mad.
We're just disappointed.
We're trying. This hurts us, Tech News, as much as it hurts you.
More so, actually.
We got a lot to talk about today. First of all, the Path controversy is not over. If you missed it, the whole controversy is that Path, the app on iOS, would automatically upload all of your contacts from your iPhone without telling you. Path apologized. They've changed the behavior to warn you that it's going to do that. But this is far from over, apparently. Twitter has admitted now that it stores user contact details, including phone numbers and email addresses, for an 18-month retention period only when you use the service's Find Friends feature, which is in the mobile app. Carolyn Penner from Twitter said, along those lines, in our next app update, which are coming soon, we are updating the language associated with Find Friends to be more explicit. In place of scan your contacts, we will use upload your contacts. So they actually admit that they're uploading them and storing them. They are not the only ones out there doing this, though. Dieter Bohn over at The Verge has a comprehensive survey of popular apps. Lots of apps doing it in lots of different ways. Some automatically, like Path, for instance, Foursquare was doing that. They have since added, like Path, a warning saying they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They only did it the first time you signed up, though. So it would just take your contacts, look for matches, and they didn't keep them the way Twitter does.
The folks over at The Verge also noticed that while Path was sort of getting raked over the coals, Instagram quietly made some adjustments to their app as
right.
well, so that now you get a prompt saying, listen, this is what we're doing, but they didn't come out with any sort of press release about it. It was just sort of, we need to change a few things because we're doing the same thing that's going to upset people.
And they gave Facebook a lot of credit. They said, look, Facebook actually does this the best, which makes most sense because Facebook is under scrutiny for privacy violations more than others. The U.S. House of Representatives, though, never far behind a good controversy, has sent a joint letter from Henry Waxman and G.K. Butterfield to Apple CEO Tim Cook, asking him about the Path incident and requiring him to answer 9 questions about how Apple handles these things, how they will handle them in the future, what penalties would be put in place, and they want Apple to answer that by February 29th. Apple has put out a statement to several blogs out there, including All Things D, that they feel that the way Path was doing contact upload before violated their terms of service. In fact, in the terms of service for developers, the developer guidelines, it says apps cannot transmit data about a user without obtaining the user's prior permission and providing the user with access to information about how and where the data will be used. It's very clear, 17.1 in the developer's guide on this. And spokesperson Tom Newmar has told several blogs, we're working to make this even better for our customers. That's so Apple. And as we have done with location services, any app wishing to access contact data will require explicit user approval in a future software release. So before it was just the guidelines that told you to do it. They're going to change the software. So there's no way to upload those contact information without forcing you to ask the user for
permission. It's the same thing that they do with location. Whenever you are going to provide geolocation information to whatever app you're using, you've got to say, yes, you can use this information.
And why is that? Because they had a similar controversy where people
exactly.
were using location information.
Yeah, but it's just a labeling issue, effectively. Because, I mean, I'm looking at the Twitter app, and I had to search for where Find Friends was, actually, in this thing, because I haven't done this in a long time. Scan your contacts is what it says. It doesn't say upload at all. So it's not super clear exactly how it's doing it. I wouldn't even think that, oh, yeah, they're going to keep my information for 18 months. Would I be surprised if it was in somewhere buried in the iTunes service? Like if it was like in their specs and what they're doing? I wouldn't be surprised if it was in there anyway. I just don't know. This pop-up notice thing, I think it's helpful up to a point. Because, yeah, the GPS thing, I'm usually quite concerned. I'm like, you don't need to know where I am all the time. I think that's a little irksome. But with these services where you are actually taking an action, like Twitter or Path, and you're trying to share within a certain kind of group, is it sort of this, could it be the mindset of these companies that there's an implicit, okay, sure, you can give us our contact information because you are trying to connect with your friends anyway?
Well, I think that for many people, it's many people are very upset about this. There are others, and I tend to be in that camp saying, listen, if the company isn't using my information for nefarious purposes, and I know that they're storing it securely, I don't have a huge problem with this because it makes my experience better. The Verge had pointed out that, for example, not all apps store our information securely. So the app Hipster, for example, which I think has been updated, and so the problem has been patched, but until now was storing address information, which sometimes includes things like what you've named your iPhone and the UDID of your iPhone itself. So not just your email address, but certain stuff about you, where they could figure out who somebody who could get the information, could figure out who the phone was attached to, could sniff it out over the internet. So that's the problem. I mean, if we can be
contactless, being sent by HTTP instead of HTTPS, right, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Stuff being stored in plain text.
Yeah, I want to know what you're doing and what you're doing with it. And I really don't have that. I mean, this is other people's data to begin with. It's not mine. So there's a certain amount of trust you put into me by saying, here's my phone number.
Right.
But you've made it quasi-public at that point anyway. It's not the same thing as the IMEI numbers that you're talking about or some of that more personal information. That's a little farther up the privacy scale. But really, I think, first of all, you should let me know what you're doing with any information you're taking off my phone so that I can say yes or no. And second of all, it just goes to show it's easier not to have friends.
That's one way to go, I guess.
Loners have no issues.
Or just unplug. Get off the grid.
Yeah, exactly.
None of this will be a worry anymore.
That's probably what the LightSquared CEOs want to do right now.
They wanted to get on the grid.
They got some bad news today.
Yesterday. The FCC said that LightSquared's proposed network, that's not going to be happening after tests found the network interferes with GPS entirely. The agency is preparing to withdraw the preliminary approval it granted last year the company, and this quote doesn't help them much. There is no mitigation strategies that both solve the interference issues and provide LightSquared with an adequate commercial network deployment. And that was Lawrence Strickling, administrator of the NTIA, in a letter to FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski. So that pretty much means that LightSquared has to figure out what to do. But tomorrow, the FCC is posting a notice seeking public comment. So I guess people try to figure out other solutions, but it doesn't look very good for them. And so what's LightSquared going to do now? They have a spectrum that they can't use for their proposed network. According to an analyst at BTIG LLC in New York, he says that LightSquared could do this. They could sell their spectrum, I don't know for what, swap it for better airwaves. They could sue the government because they had to get the spectrum somewhere in the first place and maybe reduce costs to stay afloat until they figure out some kind of solution. Sprint, they had a deal with LightSquared. That might fall apart, so Sprint might have to give back $65 million undoing its deal. And the big winners, according to that same analyst, Dish and Clearwire, because they have spectrum that is something called usable and doesn't interfere with GPS.
It's not dirty spectrum.
No, it's not
dirty. Like LightSquared's spectrum.
It's clean.
Yeah, well, I mean, frankly, this is a complex issue, and I've been cheering for LightSquared all along, not because I think they were totally in the clear and wouldn't necessarily hurt GPS, but I felt like they got a raw deal by being given this spectrum. Granted, it was meant for satellite broadcast, but they were saying, look, what we're doing is not against what you should be able to do with spectrum reasonably. It just turns out that we can't do it in this spectrum. So there's a problem there that the FCC needs to address, which is allowing bleed over, et cetera, and the unintended consequences here. In addition to the real issues with GPS and the way the receivers are manufactured, which some people pointed out, look, an aircraft's GPS equipment is less shielded than the GPS in your phone. That's the problem here, is this equipment isn't manufactured. But let's set that aside. There's also a huge industry that has a big interest in not having LightSquared out there creating a wholesaler to compete with them. And that is the current telecom industry. So you know that they're happy about this. What I'm hoping is that there could be a spectrum swap, or that maybe Dish will get into the same sort of deal with LightSquared. Maybe Dish and LightSquared can strike a deal. I hope that the LightSquared idea of creating a wholesale platform is not dead, because that would be very sad.
I mean, LightSquared this whole time has been saying that the results of these tests are just, they're not real-world tests. They're trying out the power that they're using is way too high compared to what they would actually be operating at. On top of that, they've been saying, okay, the GPS industry is against us as well. These telecoms are trying to push us out. All these things are against. They've used the words, these tests are rigged. That was like the headline in one of their press releases. So, I mean, they're going to keep trying to fight this, but I mean, they're pretty much not dead in the water, but they really need
I think what they ran up against is their rhetoric outran the reality. I think in the early part of this, it looked like there could be a solution. And it looked like there was violation happening on the GPS side of things. But in the end, the FCC realized, like, you know, whether these receivers are built right or not, you just can't operate the way you want to operate in that spectrum.
It's unfortunate, though, because LightSquared has said, listen, we've been providing documentation for years now to the GPS industry. Here are a few things that can change that will help everybody work together better. This is coming. This is going to happen. Can you work with us here? And now for the government to say, listen, we can't have airlines are going to be that you're going to be interfering with, because that's just public safety problem.
Well, and that's all about cost, right? Nobody wants to go and replace all of those. Nobody wants to pay to replace all of the equipment out there. Because theoretically, if you did that, then the spectrum could be used for what LightSquared wants to use.
Well, the FCC wants competition out there in the telecom market. I mean, we saw what happened with AT&T and T-Mobile. We know the FCC wants this. The thing is, they might likely break a deal with LightSquared to get them some other kind of way to do this. And I don't know if that spectrum is completely valueless over time. I mean, if enough laws can be changed that GPSs are required to be more shielded, then maybe in the span of, I don't know, 10 years, that spectrum can be used for other things, just not right now.
Yeah.
Maybe LightSquared was operating at a timetable that's just something that made it very difficult to use. But long term, it'll probably be valuable again.
We're all going to switch to GLONASS soon anyway. Let's move on to a couple iPad stories here. First of all, a Korea Daily Report is making the rounds, claiming that based on the average salaries of workers in China, the labor cost of an iPad is $8 or 1.6% of the cost that iPad is at retail. As a comparison, Korean factory workers get about $34 per iPad, giving them 6.8% of the sales, although not that many iPads are made in Korea. This is according to the Korea Daily Report. Wages at Foxconn are not, in fact, low by Chinese standards, though. According to Forbes, they're above average for manufacturing jobs in the country. So essentially, what's going on here is everyone is noticing that the cost of labor in China is low. And there, because we've had all this controversy about working conditions and what the working conditions are, everyone's saying, see, and they're abusing them at wages. But I don't think they are. I mean, any more than the entire Chinese labor market is abused, because the cost of labor in China is low.
That's why all the manufacturing jobs are over there, because everything is so much cheaper.
That's the whole thing about outsourcing,
is
that you pick countries where you can pay people less.
Now, the Fair Labor Agency, the Fair Labor Association, that Apple has been a part of, has been conducting investigations in Foxconn. And according to Arit Van Heerden, who's the president of the FLA, he's impressed. The quote is, the facilities are first class. The physical conditions are way, way above average of the norm. The problems are not the intensity and burnout and pressure cooker environment you have in a garment factory, which is what the FLA is used to investigating, is apparel industry. He says it's more a function of monotony, of boredom, and of alienation, perhaps. So he was impressed by how quiet the chips are when they're manufactured, because instead of these big garment machines, you know, going chunk, chunk, chunk in the background.
So it's more almost like a cultural problem. You've got these many times young people who come from rural farming areas. All of a sudden they're in a Foxconn encampment, sort of. They're working all day. They don't have any connection to their old way of life, and they're kind of sad and lonely. More than it being actually sweatshop
conditions. And they have a monotonous job where they're doing the same thing over and over.
Well, clearly the answer is to have more products. I mean, the iPad's selling, they're making the same stupid product over and over again.
I don't think that...
We need different iPads.
That's probably not.
I think they'll still just be doing the same thing. It's not... They don't get to make the product from beginning to end.
It's not like a musical chairs type of a thing.
Everybody just
move assembly lines. Yeah. Let's keep it fun.
All right, we got some more iPad news and some news about the internet in Georgia, but I want to take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. I use it multiple times a week for Forecast, for Sword and Laser, for my book, United Moon Colonies. All of those run on Squarespace blogs because it's easy, it looks good, and I have reliable servers behind me that I don't have to fret about. I don't have to worry about. So go try it out. Don't have to take my word for it. Go set up a blog. You don't have to use a credit card to sign up. It's absolutely free to try it out. You'll have a blog up and running in less than a minute if you want. Or if you have a blog already, you can import it. You don't have to close your other blog. Just import it. It's really easy to import. And then play around with it. See if you like it. You probably will. It gives you all kinds of great tools for managing your blog. And if you do decide to keep it, use this code, TNT2, and get 15% off the first 6 months of your subscription. But don't pay anything yet. Go get that free trial at squarespace.com. See if it's right for you. Or maybe if someone you know, like a business, is looking for a good way to manage a website, this is a way to go. If they're not really wanting to be involved in hosting and web hosts and all that, squarespace.com. And use that offer code TNT2 to get 15% off the first 6 months. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Now, on to that ban on iPads we were talking about yesterday. New developments.
New developments indeed. So ProView, Shenzhen, and Apple are in a heated battle over who owns the rights to the name iPad in China. ProView says, we do. And Apple says, no, you sold that to us several years ago. The what's under question is, okay, well, the Chinese courts have sided with ProView thus far. Can they get exports shut down so that iPads cannot leave China, which would really make a huge dent in the worldwide
marketplace?
Yeah, the supply chain. Well, ProView CEO Lang Long San told Reuters, the customs, Chinese customs, have told us that it'll be difficult to implement a ban because many Chinese consumers love Apple products. So ProView is pretty much saying, listen, they're not even going to work with us, even if I could get
We know you have the right to this, but people, come on, people love iPads.
We're not going to do that.
We're not
going to
do that.
They want what they want, which is sort of a weird thing for ProView to say, considering that they sort of have the upper hand here. Obviously, Apple knows this, but it's still an interesting thing to say publicly. What ProView probably is going to do is appeal to local governments, so get certain cities to not be able to sell iPads in the retail stores. Yang also said the best option is to resolve the legal dispute in an out-of-court settlement. Not a big surprise there. They want a lot of money.
What we'd like is Apple just give us money.
Yeah, it'll just be so much easier.
Because they're hurting.
They're hurting really bad. The Reuters, a couple people who are correspondents for Reuters, actually went and visited physically the Shenzhen offices. It's the address that they have on their website. And found the building. It's mostly abandoned. There's some shattered windows. There's garbage everywhere. ProView Technology Shenzhen is a unit of ProView International Holdings. Now, that parent company suffered a huge blow in the financial crisis of 2008. Hasn't really recovered since. I mean, if you look at their stock versus Apple, their shares were trading at the end of yesterday at 20 cents Hong Kong dollars. On Tuesday, Apple shares are closed at above $500 per share. What's that?
$500 US dollars,
exactly. Apple says, listen, we bought ProView's worldwide rights to the iPad trademark, 10 different countries, from this Taiwan subsidiary of ProView International. Now, the way that this worked was ProView International sold the rights to a company called IP Application Development.
IPAD.
Happens to be an acronym for iPad. Mm. And the reason for that is IP Application Development is a London-based company set up by Apple so that they could do a deal and nobody would know that Apple was buying the name
no one
iPad.
Would go, Apple bought the name iPad.
Apple's
They're coming out with
company.
A pad.
This is what Apple does.
Right.
IP Application Development bought the trademark for 35,000 British pounds, says ProView. Then they sold that iPad name to Apple for 10 pounds. So it was just sort of a...
But the controversy is that ProView says that didn't include the right to use the name in China.
Correct.
That's all this is about. And this is going to get wrapped up with a payment. Apple is holding out for the payment to be as close to nothing as possible, and ProView wants it to be much more than that.
Well, you think if
it's just
the Chinese,
a matter of the negotiations happening.
If the Chinese government's like, listen, we're not going to enforce a shutdown on exports of iPads, then what kind of a case does Priv you have? However,
you just go look at the garbage, please. We just need help.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a weird way to put windows. It. But Amazon China and Suning.com, both online retailers of iPads, have removed iPads from sales in response to this Apple versus ProView legal battle.
That's that just makes it easier for them.
Right. Yeah. According to Mike Gadget, it was Apple's doing. Apple asked Amazon China to take that iPad off its virtual shelves, at least for now.
That's
ProView says, news to us, we didn't ask them to do it. So yeah, it's kind of a messy situation, but it's probably going to work out with a check being written. A
couple of big stories to finish us up. First of all, a paper is out called Ron Was Wrong, Wit Is Right. Geek points if you get the references there. By several researchers ahead of an August conference in Santa Barbara on crypto that points out insecurities in RSA. RSA security, 1024-bit RSA keys, are what we use for public keys, which you probably know better as SSL. It's one of the main applications of it, one of the most popular applications of it. And if you don't know what SSL is, it's that little key that says, hey, you're securely connected to the website. So now you can put in your credit card information and nobody in the middle will be able to get it. So a security vulnerability in RSA is a big deal. Here's what they say they found. The way I understand the paper, they have found a way to determine the factors that are used in your private key. And just the crypto experts out there are going to cringe at this, but a real quick primer on the way this works. A public key is a number that you give out to the website that says, okay, here's how to encrypt my communications. But you can give that public key to everyone because they don't know your private key. Your private key is made by taking two prime numbers, multiplying them. There's a little bit of other magic that goes on, and that creates your public key. You, because you know what those two prime numbers are, can therefore decrypt anything that is encrypted with that public key. But unless you know the private key, the two prime numbers, you can't decrypt it, right? So that's why you can give out a public key to everyone that is used to encrypt communications that only you can decrypt. Now, here's what they found out. Using a Euclidean algorithm, don't let the name bother you, it's just a fancy math equation, they are able to determine the factors in any two numbers that share a factor. So, for example, let's say the public keys are 35 and 77. They wouldn't be because that's way insecure, but let's just say they are. Euclid's algorithm can then find the greatest common divisor, which in this case is 7. 7 times 5 is 35. 7 times 11 is 77. If you run that algorithm and you find out the common divisor is 7, now you can find out the other factor, and now you know the private key. And what they found out was that 27,000 of 7.1 million keys that they examined have common factors. And all you need is two with common factors. You run this algorithm, and you can uncover their private keys. So that's a big problem.
And the problem is that they were using prime numbers multiple times, right? Because that's how you could figure this out at all. So if you wanted
it's not a problem with RSA. In fact, Steve Gibson covered this on Security Now this morning, and he did a great job of explaining the problem isn't in the way RSA works. It's with how you determine the random numbers.
The random number generators, which are being used to create the, which are being used to find the primes, are not being seeded correctly. They're not being seeded with sufficient entropy. So looking at the technology, they don't think that the random number generators are bad, but remember, we've talked about this extensively. It is very difficult to get really random data out of computers because they're all about not being random. They're just math boxes.
Right. So if you want to know more about that, go watch the most recent episode of Security Now. They talk about this a little more. But essentially, it's how those random numbers are being created is not random enough, because pure randomness is actually almost impossible to achieve. Eric Woostrow, a second-year graduate student at the University of Michigan's Electrical Engineering and Computer Science Department, told Ars Technica that he made his own survey, and all but one of the weak keys he encountered were self-signed, and most of the weak keys they found were used to protect routers and similar gear. So it may be a problem with embedded systems and how they're creating the keys for embedded systems. We don't know that for sure, but there's probably something out there that's causing the random numbers to not be generated in a sufficiently random way.
So how does this trickle down to any user? I mean, like, if I'm just using Gmail or something now, am I supposed to be freaking out, or is this...
No, yeah, that's the thing. You're going to see all these articles, and you're going to be like, nothing is secure. Most everything is still secure. If you're using HTTPS for Gmail, you should be fine. You are in the hands of the people running the servers and creating the keys out there to make sure that they're creating random keys on their side and they don't get hacked. But the chances, remember, they have to find two public keys that have a similar factor. And then those two public keys have to be run through an algorithm, and they have to determine the factors, and it has to be for the thing you're using. So the chances that that's going to happen to what you're using are very low. The folks who wrote this paper are contacting all of the people whose insecure keys they discovered and letting them know that there's a problem, and they're putting the paper out in Santa Barbara in more detail to kind of help investigate this and figure out how to make sure that you don't have insecure keys out there.
I sort of had this visual of people walking around the streets of Santa Barbara. Extra, extra. Read all about it. Insecure. They're check, like, and see if it's you.
Dude, I'm going surfing. Leave me alone.
I don't think it's me.
Go banana slugs.
Again, that goes back to disconnecting entirely. Want to be safe? Go
banana
off the grid.
Banana slugs is Santa Cruz.
Oh, Santa Cruz. Sorry.
Yeah. Santa Barbara's the Gauchos. Wrong.
Gauchos. Go Gauchos.
Yep.
And now, publicly owned internet services is becoming illegal. That's right. This is kind of a crazy thing. Joining us to talk about it, Christopher Mitchell, Director of Telecommunications as Commons at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Hey, Chris, how's it going?
Going well. How are you?
Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate you taking the time to kind of help us explain this. This is a common problem. We've talked about it on the show before. In fact, we've talked to you about it before. In this case that we're talking about today, Bloomberg has a column up about how the Georgia legislature is currently considering a bill that would make it impossible for any city in the state to provide their own high-speed internet access network, even in areas where the private sector cannot or will not provide service. Nebraska, North Carolina, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee already have similar laws in place in various areas. South Carolina is considering one. Florida is considering one. Why would anyone want to prevent the government from providing an alternative public internet infrastructure? What is the not the secret motivations, which is basically that the ISPs don't want any competition, but what is the public justification for this?
If you listen to the lobbyists and if you listen to the Senate Majority Leader in Georgia who is pushing this bill, he says that if the private sector is convinced that the public will not offer these services, then the private sector will suddenly step up and build the networks that are needed.
So if there's one fewer competitor, then they're golden. They'll provide us everything. But if there's the possibility that one other competitor would come in, then forget it.
Right. And the absurdity there is that there's very few communities who have done this on any sort of way that challenges the AT&T or Comcast or any of the other big providers. You know, we talk about Chattanooga. Well, for what Chattanooga's done, there's about 60 other cities in the country that have done that. And so it's not a real threat hanging over the head of these providers. And we know this because they say, and they'll admit that the public sector has tremendous disadvantages. You know, you have a city that has an annual budget of $20 million, and they're going to be competing against AT&T with revenues that they're measured in tens of billions of dollars.
Right.
Obviously, AT&T has the advantage.
So what does the bill in Georgia propose? Because these laws are written with different spins. What are they actually making illegal?
So in Georgia, it's basically they took the bill from North Carolina and ran it through an organization called ALEC, which has been talked about in a number of places, and they added a couple of things. But to refresh people, North Carolina, there's a requirement for a referendum. And so we saw back in November, Comcast spent $300,000 against the city that, you know, it can't really spend any money to defend itself in the referendum. So there's a referendum requirement already. The communities will not be allowed to offer services outside of their borders. And so, and I should preface all of this by saying that this is in addition to the fact that any community provider is governed by the same rules as the private sector providers, mostly state and federal regulations. So these are new regulations that only apply to public sector providers. Their referendum actually has a requirement that they use certain language saying that if the network were to not succeed, then the city taxpayers would have to pay for the overruns, which is not true. It totally depends on the financing source. And there's a lot of other really, really complicated things that I don't want to get into, but it's language that's written in such a way to allow state legislators to say, oh, well, we're just trying to make a level playing field, when in reality, the sum total of all of these new regulations that only apply to the public sector prevents communities from building the kind of networks that Chattanooga has.
Are there, are you aware of any other industries where the government has said, okay, the state cannot get into this business, cannot provide this service?
You know, nothing really comes to mind. There's some regulations that have a blanket, you know, the city should not compete with the private sector in general. These are often narrowly intended, but they are used as evidence that the public should never compete with the private. The reality is that, you know, we have public police forces, fire departments, we have private fire departments and security firms, we have public schools and private schools, we got public buses and private taxis. There's a whole bunch of ways in which we overlap. And in the case of broadband, if the private sector is not building these networks, our position isn't that the community should have to build a network. Our position is the community should have the choice and they should decide for themselves what kind of investment they may make.
So what can communities do? I mean, what kind of benefits can they put forth to say, hey, this law will prevent us from having this benefit? And what can they do if they want to try to affect how this legislation is made?
Well, the first thing is to make sure that that people are telling their elected officials that this decision needs to be made locally. This is not a decision that the state should say no one is allowed to build these networks, whether it's done in one sentence or in 400 pages. So that's the first thing, is people have to tell their elected officials that this decision needs to be made locally. The next is if a community actually wants to get involved, they should take a look at what other communities have done. Some communities have just built the infrastructure and let the private sector provide services over it. Other communities have gone all the way to offering all kinds of services. But there's one other point that I actually just wanted to get back to really quickly, and that's the point here is that if you listen to AT&T's lobbyists, they say, we're going to build these networks if you don't let the private sector do it. But AT&T's CEO just told investors, quote, "We have all been trying to find a broadband solution that was economically viable to get out to rural America, and we're not finding one, to be quite candid. We're looking at rural America and asking, what's the broadband solution? We don't have one right now." And so it's a matter of these communities need something. And in the private sector, in this case, the powerful, the big guys, they're the ones that are lobbying to cut off solutions, even when they can't provide one themselves.
Now, Susan Crawford, in her Bloomberg column, points out that we went through all this before in the early 1900s regarding electricity. It was seen as sort of a privilege. It was seen as something that should be privately provisioned. There were fights against local provision, and they ended up allowing local provisions in a lot of places because rural areas wanted electrification, and the big companies that were controlling electricity wouldn't do it. So it's following that same pattern, and even, as she points out, a lot of the same dialogue. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Let folks know where they can go to find out more about these and other kinds of municipal network issues that you deal with.
Sure. So I write regularly at a site called muninetworks.org, and that's where we cover exactly what communities are doing. But we've just launched decidelocally.com, and that's just designed to help communities to preserve their authority, regardless of what decision they may or may not make. And then, as you can see, I'm at CommunityNets on Twitter.
All right. Thanks again, Chris. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Let's move on to the news views. Cisco apparently just realized Microsoft bought Skype. They want the European Union to reconsider its approval of Microsoft's acquisition of Skype. They don't want them to overturn it, but in a blog post, Senior Vice President of Emergence Business Group, Martin De Beer, asks for conditions to be placed on the deal to ensure greater standards-based interoperability, and they make clear that Cisco doesn't oppose the merger. They just want Cisco devices to be able to be used over Skype and Link in a Microsoft system. Cisco also is joined by MessageNet, which is a European VoIP company.
And we are joined by Patent Wars. So Kodak is suing Apple over patent infringement. Apple has asked a bankruptcy judge for permission to sue Kodak in the ITC and a district court over, yes, you guessed it, patents. Apple didn't even need to ask permission, but its lawyers said it is doing so out of an abundance of caution.
So it's going to be cautious there. Sony issued an apology for increasing the prices of Whitney Houston albums on iTunes UK the day after she died. Many people thought the label was trying to make a quick buck on the singer's death, but Sony's statement says the price change was a mistake and the company corrected the price that same day. So Sony's sorry.
They're very sorry. The SEC told telecoms like AT&T that it must allow shareholders to vote when it comes to the company's net neutrality principles. Organizations like Trillium have been trying to gain access to this kind of thing for at least 4 years. Previously, the carriers were able to omit the issue from a shareholder vote by claiming net neutrality was not a significant policy under SEC definitions.
One of the most interesting parts of that story is the fact that Mike D of the Beastie Boys is a shareholder.
He was on the mic, yeah.
That was in all those headlines, and it confused the heck out of me. Well, what does Mike D have to do with net neutrality?
It's a lot less about him, but it makes for a good headline.
Get on the mic, Mike, and prevent net neutrality.
A Samsung guide for Mobile World Congress may have leaked, and it says that the Galaxy Note 10.1 will be included in an exhibition there. The Verge found some information at a casting call site that also mentions that Galaxy Note 10.1. So Samsung has mentioned it would be trying out all kinds of variants of tablet, but we'll have to find out at the end of the month if this is true.
Matthias Ortmann, the co-founder and CTO of Mega Upload, has been released on bail under some conditions, including Ortmann cannot access the internet while he's out on bail. The U.S. will use a U.N. treaty to extradite people related to Mega Upload. And currently of the accused Mega Upload team in New Zealand, only Kim.com is still locked up, but his court date's coming up.
AMD announced two affordable models in its 28-nanometer Radeon HD range. The 7770 lists for $169, cheap, and is billed as the world's first reference GPU factory clocked to 1 gigahertz. The 7750 sells for an even cheaper $109 and boasts a low 75 watts, so it doesn't even require its own power connector. Reviews have been mixed. AnandTech liked the power-to-performance ratio of the cards, but not the price-to-performance ratio of the 7770.
Motorola Android users may rejoice because you will get ice cream sandwich eventually. Moto updated its chart. You know, those charts that show when the phones are going to be upgraded. Devices like the U.S. versions of the Droid 4, the Razer Max, and the Zyboard are in the evaluation and planning phase. No specific time was given by Motorola, though. Although, if you've got the Moto Razr outside the U.S., rollouts are scheduled for the second quarter.
So could it be Verizon screwing this up?
Sounds like it might be.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Google has fixed a Google Wallet flaw that and now supports prepaid cards again. Back on Monday, Google disabled the usage of prepaid cards from Google Wallet because a little hack would allow access to prepaid funds on the device. So that's a problem. Google Wallet is still vulnerable on rooted phones to brute force attacks. So good luck.
On to the calendar.
AT&T has expanded their LTE network in the Tampa Bay, St. Petersburg metropolitan area, bringing LTE total to 28 markets in the U.S. They're also expanding LTE coverage in North Carolina to include Durham, along with parts of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. I still got a while to catch up to Verizon, but doing their best. RIM has set the Playbook 2.0 release for Mobile World Congress 2012, February 29th in Barcelona.
Exciting for me.
Yes. Are you going?
No, but I have a Playbook.
Oh, right, right, right. It's exciting for you.
Right there.
Yeah, it's been there for about 2 or 3 weeks, actually, since I returned it.
Tom needs a reason to use it.
Been waiting for that update.
Facebook is bringing its timeline profile pages to brands later this month in the U.S., according to executives briefed on Facebook's company plans. Those executives, they're always briefed on stuff. And we want to wish a very happy birthday to YouTube, which debuted in 2005. This is also the same day that Kevin Mitnick famously went to jail. In 1995.
Oh, well, happy freedom, Kevin Mitnick.
Yes.
And happy birthday, YouTube.
You've brought us so many skateboard videos. How could we ever thank you?
We will celebrate YouTube's birthday in incoming.
Incoming message.
Because on YouTube, Mike sent us a video message about Aereo.
Good morning, TNT crew. My name is Mike, and I live on the northwest side of Tucson, a little town called Oro Valley. And the reason why I'm sending this video in, it's regards to your discussion on show 437 about the new service that's coming to New York called Aereo. And that is something I would be very excited about here in Tucson if we could get it. The reason being, I cut the cord recently. I have a Roku box, which I love it. And I love rediscovering all my tech news on it. And I watch a lot of Twit TV on it. What I can't watch, I do have an HD antenna, but what I can't watch is Fox and NBC. I just can't pick those up where I live. So I have ABC and CBS, which is good for college football, but I don't have the NBC and the Fox, which is bad for NFL football, which I love the NFL. And so that's one of my frustrations for cutting the cord. And one reason why, you know, I get tempted to go back to cable for $100 a month. You know, if I could pay $12
so
a month.
So he keeps going to explain some of the details about his connection there. And we'll have the whole video voicemail up there on YouTube in our links at the show notes. But suffice to say, a lot of people can't get over-the-air broadcast the way they would like to, but they should be able to, and the Aereo service would help them.
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, there's like some communities have restrictions about antennas that you could have on your house. I mean, if you get a large enough antenna and it basically looks like a giant old radio antenna, maybe you can get those signals from way out there. But this kind of alternative is something that people should really consider.
On to the email, Sarah.
Sean from Virginia Beach says, hey, TNT crew, I was listening to episode 436 Monday, and you were talking about Windows 8 Metro-style browsers. I've been listening to Twit podcast for almost 2 years, and I've found a lot of great tips from the shows like LastPass. I think if extensions list LastPass cannot be used on Metro-style browsers, that's a no-go for me because I live by extensions like LastPass, and I couldn't live without it until now. Just wanted to put my 2 cents in.
How do you use LastPass on an iPad?
You get an app.
Also, let's just appify all the extensions.
Exactly. It's just like Netflix. You were pointing that out in prep, right?
Silverlight doesn't work on Metro browser. Well, guess what? Netflix app.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the sort of thing about extensions for IE is really going to affect the Windows 8 on tablets more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I think that we'll find out. And it's going to be an unfair comparison because we're used to Windows doing one thing, but we're used to tablets doing another, and Microsoft's trying to strike.
Don't forget, all the Metro apps will run on both. So you'll be able to get the Netflix app on the x86 version as well. Last email from Jordan Patterson. I think there's a nice little piece of news here talking about how Jim Gaffigan is trying the Louis C.K. experiment. Jim Gaffigan is nice. Going to offer Mr. Universe for $5 for download, and a portion goes, a dollar from each of the download goes directly to the Bob Woodruff Foundation. So that's really nice to know.
Oh, good to know. Thanks, Jordan, for sending that along. All right, Randall Bennett was supposed to be with us, but he had to cancel. We'll try to get him back at some point. Sorry he couldn't make it with us today, but we will be back tomorrow with an all-new episode. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. In fact, Martin Giles, the technology correspondent for the United States for the magazine The Economist, joins us on TNT. We'll see you then.
Oh, many jazz hands.